Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedures Practice Group is hosting a discussion on the honest services cases, the Supreme Court's decision in United States versus Skilling, United States versus Black, and United States versus Weyruch regarding the honest services statute, which held that Section 18 U.S.C. Section 1346, which criminalized schemes to deprive another of the intangible right of honest services, is unconstitutionally vague beyond a core set of circumstances involving bribes or kickbacks. My name is Jim Dunlap. I'll be moderating this discussion. I'm criminal counsel at Jones Day in Chicago. I'll be joined today by John Klein, a leading criminal lawyer at the trial and appellate level, who was co-counsel in such cases as U.S. versus Oliver North and U.S. versus Scooter Libby, and an honest services case I'm sure we'll discuss today, U.S. versus Sorich. We'll next hear from Bill Otis, a retired career federal prosecutor from the Eastern District of Virginia, now adjunct professor at Georgetown Law School, and then by John Baker, professor of law at Louisiana State University, with a little bit of follow-up from the retired prosecutor, Bill Otis, after which we'll go to questions. So now I'd like to invite you, John Klein, to give us your thoughts on the Supreme Court's decision in the honest services cases.
Thanks very much, Jim. I appreciate the introduction. From the defense perspective, the outcome in yesterday's cases was probably the second best possible result. The defense argued that the statute 1346 should be struck down in its entirety as vague. That view attracted three votes, Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy, but it was rejected by the six-vote majority. The court ended up limiting the statute to bribes and kickbacks, which was, as I mentioned, the second best outcome for the defense. The court rejected the government's argument for a third category to be encompassed in honest services. And that category, which was somewhat amorphous and a little bit hard to grasp, involved undisclosed conflicts of interest or undisclosed personal interest resulting in personal financial gain. And the court unanimously viewed that theory of liability as simply too amorphous and too vague to read into the statute. Interestingly, in a footnote, footnote 45, the court also suggested that even if Congress wanted to write that theory of liability into 1346, it would have a hard time doing so without running afoul of the vagueness doctrine. So the court seems to be quite firm in the view that the statute must be limited to bribes and kickbacks. Going forward, in the trial courts and in the courts of appeals, I think we can expect to see the government do its best to expand these categories of bribery and kickbacks to encompass types of conduct that would not ordinarily be considered to fall within those categories. In particular, the quid pro quo requirement of bribery, I think we can expect to see the government try to diminish as much as it can and to look for, try to criminalize categories of conduct that don't involve the sort of quid pro quo that usually is typical in bribery cases. The court, I think, sent a signal, a fairly strong signal, that it will insist upon fairly strict adherence to the traditional notions of bribery and kickbacks. At page 48 of the decision, in describing what bribery and kickbacks will encompass, the court cites the 18 U.S.C. section 201B, which is the bribery provision of the federal code involving bribery of federal officials. It did not cite to section 201C, which is the gratuity provision. That suggests that the court will maintain a line between bribery and gratuities in the honest services field. Another issue that we can expect to see debated was one that Justice Scalia focused on in his partial concurrence and partial dissent, which is the type of fiduciary duty that's going to have to be established to pursue these bribery and kickback theories. It's not just any bribe or any kickback that's going to be culpable under 1346. There has to be a fiduciary duty involved as well. That's clear from both the majority opinion and Justice Scalia's dissent, or concurrence, and I imagine that we will see a fair amount of debate in the lower courts over what that fiduciary duty entails. The final point, from a practical standpoint, that I wanted to make is the effect that this decision will have on pending cases. There are cases on direct appeal where this issue will come up. There are also, of course, many decided cases where people were convicted on theories of honest services that are not encompassed in the bribery and kickback rubric that the court adopted yesterday. And I think the key issue in a lot of those cases is going to be harmless error. The government frequently charged honest services as an alternative theory in a single count with money or property mail fraud. That is now subject to harmless error review, and I think you're going to see a lot of debate, both on direct appeal and on habeas review, over whether the improper honest services theory is harmless in light of the evidence on the money or property theory. That's what's going to happen to the Skilling case. It got sent back for that sort of review. It's what's going to happen to the Black case. It likewise got sent back for harmless error review. And I think there'll be a great deal of dispute in the lower courts on that topic. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Bill Otis, from your perspective as a longtime federal prosecutor, what's your take on these cases?
Well, Skilling was the most important of the three honest service cases handed down yesterday. And to be blunt, seldom have I seen a defendant suffer a more devastating win. Skilling, if you recall, was one of the Enron executives who made a fortune short-selling Enron stock while casting a series of breathtaking lies to shareholders and employees about Enron's true financial condition. Now, Skilling won what was certainly the most hyped part of the case. That is, he won the vacating of his conviction for conspiring to violate the honest services statute on the ground that the conviction came about under what the Supreme Court majority decided was an excessively broad construction of the law. But that is pretty much as far as it went for Skilling. His conviction was not reversed. It was remanded to the lower courts to determine whether the error was harmless, viewed against the backdrop of the other massive evidence of Skilling's deceitful behavior. Almost everything else in the case was bad news for Skilling, and I think for other honest services defendants, past and future. First, in something that was another part of the case, not related, not directly related to the honest services business, Skilling lost its challenge to the trial as a whole as having been undertaken against a backdrop of adverse, if not venomous, publicity that made a fair trial in Houston impossible. I think this was to be expected. For the court to have held otherwise would be to put a premium on the audacity of the defendant's crime. Where, for example, were we to try Timothy McVeigh? You know, the backside of the moon, you know, Neptune? When you engage in a crime that is this breathtaking in its scope, in its dishonesty and the harm it causes, there are going to be difficulties in finding a fair venue. And the Supreme Court's answer is we do the best we can, and the trial court has to take significant safeguards. It did so here. So Skilling was properly tried in Houston. The second thing that I think is important about this case is that Skilling lost his facial challenge to the honest services statute. The court held point blank that the statute is not unconstitutionally vague when limited to bribes and kickbacks. It was not so limited in the instructions given on the conspiracy count in this particular case, so Skilling won the vacating of that single count. But for two reasons, the Department of Justice must be thrilled that the statute survived at all. The first is that, as the court pointed out, and I'm quoting here, the vast majority of honest services cases involve offenders who, in violation of a fiduciary duty, participated in bribery or kickback schemes, unquote. Thus, the statute remains available without legislative rewriting for almost all the cases in which the department would want to use it, including the ongoing trial of former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. The second reason the department should be happy with the outcome is that most observers of the oral argument had already counted the statute as dead meat. Justice Scalia, who dissented here, was leading the charge against it and was hard to find a single voice on the court who resisted his attack. But in the opinion, Scalia was able to carry with him only Justices Thomas and Kennedy. Justice Breyer, who had seemed openly to ridicule the statute at oral argument, joined the majority, finding the statute constitutional as limited. The best news here may be in the longer-term implications for the approach the court used to preserve the core of the honest services statute. From a law professor's point of view, the most interesting aspect of the decision is the debate between Justice Ginsburg and Justice Scalia about whether a limiting construction of a statute amounts to respect for or an abrogation of Congress's sole power to write the law. Scalia accuses the majority of simply judicially enacting the honest services statute it wants. Ginsburg answers that preservation of the statute in a modestly limited form, but in a form consistent with the great majority of interpretations adopted over many years of lower court interpretation, shows respect for Congress and restraint in exercising the court's power to invalidate the statute in its entirety. Reasonable minds will differ on who won that debate, Justice Ginsburg or Justice Scalia, but what is most telling to me is that each side was trying to show that it was the most devoted to judicial restraint. Compared with the breezy, if not nearly unconscious, assumption of judicial superiority of the Warren Court, this is itself both gratifying and important. It's a signal that the conservative legal movement, while far from universally successful in winning substantive points over these last few years, has certainly changed the terms in which the debate is conducted.
Thanks very much, Bill. And John Baker, can you give us your perspective?
Yes, in a certain way I agree with Bill, which we often don't agree on things here. Skilling did more to help others than he did to help himself. And certainly the Department of Justice ought to be thrilled that this statute wasn't knocked out as I think most people expected. And Bill has properly identified, I think, what the critical constitutional issue is. And it has to do with the action of the court in, quote, limiting the statute and Scalia's attack, saying that they had no right to do so. So I want to look at that primarily because Bill's laid it out already, basically. I think that Scalia's opinion is absolutely devastating if you actually look at what the Ginsburg opinion says and then you read what Scalia says. I mean, if you're not thinking about separation of powers and you don't understand that separation of powers has meant that courts don't draft a statute, then, you know, it may seem very reasonable for the court to say, oh, you know, we will just apply this in a limited sense to certain cases that we think are reasonably within the statute. Scalia's rejoinder is that, look, not only do we not have that right to do it in terms of the Constitution, but wherever we limit a statute, there has to be two reasonable interpretations of the statute, and we adopt the narrower one in order to uphold the statute. And then he goes on to show how there is absolutely no ascertainable standard of guilt in this statute. The statute itself, one has to understand, and certainly all those on the call do, was an addition by Congress after the court had declared unconstitutional the honest services addition or layering onto the mail and wire fraud statutes by the courts. And then when Congress came back, instead of defining what they were doing, they just adopted, quote, the pre-McNally standard, as if this were clear. And so a big part of Scalia's opinion is showing that is crazy. You couldn't find a clear standard of guilt prior to McNally. I just want to read a short piece of this where he is summarizing all of the cases that he has reviewed and showing the absolute contradiction from case to case, from circuit to circuit. And he is detailing what the possibilities are in terms of what might or might not be criminalized under honest services. Quote, the possibilities range from any action that is contrary to public policy or otherwise immoral, to only the disloyalty of a public official or employee to his principal, to only the secret use of a perpetrator's position of trust in order to harm whomever he is beholden to. The duty probably did not have to be rooted in state law, but maybe it did. It might have been more demanding in the case of public officials, but perhaps not. At the time 1346 was enacted, there was no settled criterion for choosing among these options, for conclusively settling what was in and what was out. And when you add to that what Bill was talking about, that justice puts different theories together in the same count, it makes it very, very difficult for defendants to defend because they're not given adequate notice. I think the only proper constitutional way to have viewed this statute was it is unconstitutional as it is actually written, and the job is for the Congress to go back and rewrite it if they wish to, rather than to have the court do its job for it. The business of separation of powers is to separate the legislative and the judicial function. That's the key to liberty. And as the Federalist says, if those two functions ever get joined together, that's the very definition of tyranny.
Thank you, John. And Bill, as a former government lawyer, we'll give you a little rebuttal.
I think John makes a quite appealing case that Justice Scalia did have the better of the argument with Ginsburg, and the reasons that any sensible person should be quite concerned when there is a merging of the separation of powers. The reason I said and continue to believe that reasonable minds can differ on whether Scalia or Ginsburg has the better of the argument is that Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito were in agreement with Justice Ginsburg. Those two fellas are very smart. They have shown over their service in the Supreme Court and their prior service in the Courts of Appeals that they are attentive to separation of powers issues and otherwise to applying the Constitution as written. So I am comforted in any event by their agreement with the majority opinion that I, by and large, support. The second and last thing I would say, and this is not so much by way of rebuttal as it is to an overall observation, that in the Supreme Court's discussion of the Honest Services Statute, I think it is wise for us to remember honesty. I mean, how can one evaluate an Honest Services Statute and just ignore the underlying concept of honesty, without which both civic, judicial, and commercial life cannot proceed with the trust that is necessary for their success. As I look around me, I see a culture that is being swallowed in dishonesty. Dishonesty from government officials in the executive and legislative branch, commercial dishonesty of the kind that happened in this Enron case and with Skilling himself, in which his dishonesty and outright lying was just breathtaking, dishonesty in the mortgage and banking industries that led to a catastrophic collapse of the entire financial industry and the biggest economic recession since the Great Depression. We can't divorce from our discussion of law the culture in which that law arises and the enormous social and economic damage that comes from honesty that the law will not take seriously and punish.
May I respond?
Absolutely.
It is true about Alito and Roberts, but there are several points of interest here. First of all, I think that Justice Alito is still very much in the former prosecutorial mode, and it may be well difficult for somebody who prosecuted a lot of these cases to admit that maybe he was wrong. But secondly, as to Chief Justice Roberts, we know that he likes to decide things on the narrowest possible ground, and you could say that this was the narrower of the two grounds. In terms of vote gathering, if Justice Alito didn't come on board, there's only four votes. had Justice Alito come on board, I think that Justice Roberts probably would have come on board. But there's something else here regarding their replacement of Justices Rehnquist and O'Connor. There's virtually no discussion, I think absolutely no discussion in this opinion, about federalism. And that is quite a difference, because both Justices Alito and Roberts, their entire career has been federal, whereas Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice O'Connor paid a lot of attention to the infringement of federal criminal statutes on the states. And that is, by and large, very much true with the mail fraud and wire fraud statutes generally. As Justice Scalia said in an earlier opinion, the statute is not about mail and fraud. It is supposed to be about fraud through the mails. And that's a big difference. Bill goes to the point of honesty, and here reasonable minds can disagree. First of all, I don't think it is the business of government to simply criminalize dishonesty. There are certain forms of dishonesty, theft, stealing, perjury, etc., that have to be criminalized. But historically, this society has not criminalized every immoral act. And I think it is a terrible path to go down. And I take that by way of view of some of my work in Latin America. In Latin America, you have a tremendous culture of distrust and dishonesty. And many of the things that are perfectly acceptable in business practice up here are in fact criminal down there in theory, but in fact are not prosecuted. One of my major objections to the over-federalization of crime is that despite the good intentions of Bill and other people, I think it is terribly imprudent, to say the least, because what we're doing in the name of policing dishonesty is actually treasonous to the Constitution. When you violate the fundamental tenets of federalism and separation of powers, isn't that itself a serious form of corruption?
Thank you very much. I want to stay with this theme of whether the paring back of the statute is something about which reasonable minds can differ, because the question I really am wondering about is whether it's an effective pare back. And Justice Scalia said in his opinion that you might be able to say that Congress at least intended the statute to cover bribes and kickbacks, but I wonder if there isn't still a lot of vagueness remaining even in the concept of bribes and kickbacks. For example, are political favors bribes? Do they convey something of value even if it's not monetary? Or what about common lobbying activities such as providing dinners and sports tickets either in a public setting between lobbyists and legislators or in a private setting between purchasing agents and vendors? Do those constitute bribes? And I think there are a couple of interesting cases. John Klein, you might want to talk about Sorich with respect to this. And there's also the Abramoff case in which Jack Abramoff was convicted essentially on a referral fee scheme whereby he advocated that his clients hire someone who then paid him a fee that was regarded as a kickback in the context of the case but might also be seen as a referral fee. And I wonder if there isn't just a lot of vagueness on where to draw those lines, maybe in a way that's supportive of Justice Scalia's view in this case. John Klein, do you want to start?
I'd be happy to. And let me preface this by saying, in response to Bill and John, I don't know that the Department of Justice is so thrilled with this decision, in part because it has lopped off a whole theory that the government has used to prosecute a number of cases, including the Sorich case, which I'll talk about in a second. The government has used the Honest Services Statute to pursue undisclosed conflicts of interest, what are basically violations of state disclosure rules, and has used the 1346 to criminalize those disclosure violations, which under state law often are not criminal at all or maybe are misdemeanors. In the Wyrock case, the government went even farther, and what Wyrock failed to disclose, allegedly, wasn't required to be disclosed under the state disclosure rules, but the government, under this third theory that the Supreme Court rejected, took the view that that was nonetheless a violation of 1346. So that whole theory has been taken off the table, and the government had used that theory increasingly to prosecute behavior that it deemed unseemly, particularly by state officials, and I think the Department of Justice can't be happy about that. Now, that leaves the question that Jim just raised of how broadly the bribe and kickback theories will be construed. I think a case such as Sorich's, where there were no allegation of bribery, no allegation of kickbacks, no personal gain to Sorich at all. In essence, what he was charged with doing was violating a federal consent decree that barred patronage hiring, and doing it allegedly by means of deception. That type of theory, I think, is now clearly out of bounds. A theory along the lines of the Abramoff theory, I think, is certainly going to be very problematic. What I think the court meant to require is core bribery-type conduct, which typically involves a quid pro quo of some type. And courts have debated in the context of the bribery statutes, 201 and 666, how explicit the quid pro quo has to be, whether a stream of benefits over time with the expectation of favorable action in return is sufficient to establish a quid pro quo. But I think the core bribery concept is fairly clear. I think the government will try to expand it, but I think the Supreme Court sent a pretty strong signal that efforts to expand that core concept shouldn't succeed.
And John, just to be clear for our listeners, Sorich was the mayor of Chicago's patronage chief who was accused of essentially trading jobs for political favors. Isn't that right?
That was the basic theory, that there was a federal consent decree in Chicago that barred patronage hiring. The government's allegation was that Sorich, on behalf of the mayor and the city of Chicago, engaged in patronage hiring. There was deception allegedly involved. Test results were rigged and that kind of thing. And that was charged as honest services fraud, even though there were no bribes, no kickbacks, no personal gain of any kind to Sorich or any of the alleged co-conspirators. And that marked, I would say, the high water mark of the honest services theory, pre-Skilling. It was really in a category by itself. It was even outside this third category that the court rejected in Skilling that the government had advocated.
Does anyone have a different view about whether the pareback provides more clarity or still leaves things relatively clouded when it comes to kickback?
Let me say one thing about the notion that some of these theories that the government had previously used in its prosecutions under the Honest Services Statute are now thrown into question. I think as a general matter, one cannot dispute that. But there's a lot more that an ordinary person would understand to be a bribe, and the law would count as a bribe, than I think is being given credit for. Let me refer specifically to the Weyroush case, which was also decided yesterday. What was going on there is that Weyroush, at the time a state legislator in Alaska, stuck in, part of the team that was drafting the bill. He stuck in a provision that was favorable to a company with whom he was angling for a fat job after he left the legislature. Now, most ordinary people would understand that that's a payoff. And I think one of the things that he was arguing, indeed the principal thing he was arguing, is that the Honest Services Statute should be limited to where state law made the public official's behavior a crime, either felony or misdemeanor, or at least some kind of violation. And I thought it pretty interesting that the court never said any such thing yesterday. And as a result of that, I think that because what was going on with Weyroush was under an ordinary understanding a bribe, I think he's in big trouble on remand. I think the three defendants yesterday who has the best chance, I think it's Conrad Black. because while what he was doing was dishonest and tricky, and he knew it because when they sent him a subpoena for the records that would disclose what he was up to, he went into his office with his chauffeur and his secretary on one Saturday and cleaned out the documents that had been subpoenaed and then took them in a big box out the fire escape. But nonetheless, it did not involve a bribe. So I think Black is probably going to get off. I think Mr. Skilling probably is not going to get off on a harmless error theory, and I think Weyroush is going to get convicted under the honest services statute as it was construed yesterday.
I hope that John Klein is right, but I don't think so, and I base that on just the pattern of the Justice Department and the incentives involved. For instance, after McNally, the Cleveland case from Louisiana involving a license, they tried to shoehorn that in, and the court rejected it. And it was basically a repackaging of a theory. And then if you look at the pattern of what justice does, is they take the theory and repackage it and relabel it. Moreover, there's no disincentive at the indicting level not to do that, because the chances are that if you indict on a novel theory and the defense tries to get it thrown out at the district level, very few district judges are willing to rule with the defense at that point. From their point of view, it is safer to simply let the matter go to trial. Once it goes to trial and it goes on appeal, if there is a conviction, it's muddled at the appellate level. And rather than looking at the issue as a pure issue of law, it gets clouded by, quote, the overwhelming dishonesty of the defendant, as Bill has argued it, and as most U.S. attorneys do argue it. And I suggest that the issue of law is separate from the badness of the character involved. But back at the district level, so many of the cases end up in pleas anyway, that de facto justice is able to bring these novel theories with very little cost involved. It would be better, it seems to me, if there were a statute from Congress allowing interlocutory appeals on legitimate constitutional challenges, recognizing that district court judges generally will not go out on a limb and declare that the indictment is bad for whatever reason related to the substantive law.
Thank you, John. You were also speaking earlier about your concerns about the overcriminalization of conduct, which, while perhaps reprehensible, is difficult, at least under the honest services statute, as it was interpreted to find criminal, or easy under as to find a criminal as it was interpreted, but maybe more difficult with the pared back version. Justice Ginsburg expressed her concern that if the statute were invalidated entirely, other criminal statutes might not provide adequate reach for the government to prosecute some fraudulent schemes. And I'd like to ask you and the other panelists if that's really plausible, especially given that the substantive offenses of mail fraud and wire fraud are normally charged, or bank fraud, for example, along with an honest services count. And also, isn't that kind of reasoning really a legislative rather than a judicial consideration?
Well, I think you know my answer, and I remember that footnote or wherever it was that Justice Ginsburg said that, and she said these might go unpunished. Well, wait a minute. One, we still have states, and two, you can say, well, the state prosecutors aren't likely to prosecute this. And this has been much of the justification for federal prosecutors, and I realize they do it with good intent. But, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intent. And that still doesn't justify infringing constitutionally in areas that the feds simply do not belong.
I think the road to hell is also paved with unredressed dishonesty and greed. Indeed, the shrubbery along the road. If you want to know why the federal government needs to become involved with this, just look at this Blago trial, the trial of the former governor of Illinois. Can we really trust justice to be done for people who fiduciary obligations, both as public officials and in the private sector in the state of Illinois. If I recall correctly, it wasn't all that long ago that there was something called Operation Blacklord. Operation Blacklord was a federal investigation, and that resulted in the indictment and conviction of a number of Chicago judges, state judges in Chicago, for taking money to release guilty people. When the state judicial system itself is infected with this kind of dishonesty, it cannot be trusted to police itself. The only place to go for ordinary litigants who go into state court expecting a fair shake and expecting an honest judge, the only place to go to get it is federal jurisdiction. And that's being proved again this very day in this Blagojevich trial, in which he was basically selling a Senate seat.
But wait a minute. This is what Justice Scalia's point is. There are ways to deal with proper jurisdictional issues, and a properly drafted statute would have no difficulty in constitutional terms dealing with something that is an assault on a federal office. That is, it's always been recognized that any direct offense against the federal government is within the federal government's criminal jurisdiction. I've not questioned that. No one else has questioned that. The framers were not unaware of corruption in state courts. Indeed, that's a big part of why we have federal courts. But they did not give the authority to prosecute state officials for violations of state law. There are other mechanisms in the Constitution that deal with that. And if you want to go and simply say that we need to prosecute federally state officials, then let's get a constitutional amendment on that. And how is it that we protect against the abuse of power by federal prosecutors? That's really what the framers were more concerned about. The reality is, as bad as states can get, you can vote with your feet and you can leave and go to another state. The reality with the abuse of federal criminal power is there's nowhere in the world you can escape it.
I think this is John Klein. I think it's also a remarkable proposition, and contrary to the way criminal justice has been viewed in this country throughout, that the states are incapable of regulating themselves, and that a wiser, better, more honest federal government needs to step in and police these matters. I think there are many ways that the citizens of a state can redress dishonesty in their public officials, at the ballot box, and
let me ask
what the
evidence is that the citizens of Illinois and the state of Illinois have been successful in policing themselves.
The evidence of the people in the state of Illinois?
That's correct. They had the just recently removed Democratic Governor Blagojevich on trial for selling Barack Obama's Senate seat. The former Republican governor that preceded him, George Ryan, is now in federal prison for his work as a lower-ranking official of the state of Illinois in selling, I think it was driver's licenses or some such thing, but he got a considerable prison sentence for his corruption as governor of Illinois. We had Otto Kerner. We had Operation Blacklord about the Chicago court system. I just want to know what the evidence is that without federal intervention, the citizens of Illinois would have anything that even had a hope of approaching an honest judicial system.
And how effective has that federal intervention been?
Because Operation
a lot more effective than the state had been doing on its own, because none of those people, none of those crooks, would have had there would not have been a sanction against any of them, but for federal prosecution. Some honesty and some redress for deceitful and dishonest public service is better than none.
Well,
and
Bill,
none is what had been going on.
Bill, if it is unconstitutional to do it, is it justified?
No, it is not. But the Supreme Court did not hold that it was unconstitutional.
Oh, so it's only
that the statute must be properly cabined.
Is there not an obligation on the Justice Department to, quote, cabin itself ahead of time? Because this has been going on for 60 years with honest services, and it's now just been cabined. Should a department of the federal government engage in whatever conduct it can, pushing the envelope on the Constitution as long as it can, and convicting people who, it turns out, shouldn't have been convicted in some cases, and then say, okay, we're not going to do it at this point now that the court has told us what we can't do? I mean, you talked about judicial restraint. That seems to me to be anything but restraint in terms of the Constitution. You're relying on judges after the fact to tell you what the Constitution does or doesn't allow.
I think that the department, well, let me say first that I share your skepticism about giving excessively broad discretion to federal prosecutors. The question is, what's excessive? Some discretion, indeed a considerable amount of discretion in prosecutors as officers of the judicial branch, is both inevitable and desirable. And as has always been the case, the question will come down to have you got sensible, balanced, honest people doing the prosecution from the Department of Justice? When you do, now it's not, again, the Constitution does not guarantee that such people will always be in the role of prosecutors. We saw, for example, Mike Nifong, who is not a federal prosecutor, who did have a prosecutor's powers, who was just completely corrupt, prosecuted people he knew in advance to be innocent. The problem is that there are always going to be bad apples on the prosecution side. But given that, the prosecutors in this case, for example, in both the Blagojevich case and in the Skilling case, it seems to me are entitled to go with what at the time is a reasonable interpretation of the law. The Court of Appeals agreed with them that it wasn't a reasonable interpretation of the law. The Supreme Court disagreed but did not say that the Department of Justice was, you know, acting either out of bad motives or out of an unreasonable interpretation of existing law in going forward with this Skilling prosecution.
This is Jim Dunlap. I'm, of course, in Chicago and watching this trial very carefully and have some representations connected with it. The Gaylord investigation of judicial corruption is now about 20 years old, and we've had quite a significant number of honest services public corruption investigation since then, with what one can only describe in Illinois, I think, is a high degree of recidivism among state officials with respect to various dishonest schemes. However, the federalism concerns that have arisen here, and I'll just throw them out for people to comment on, underneath some of these trials have been interesting. So while Governor Blagojevich's indictment really speaks directly to bribes and kickbacks, a scheme to sit down, steer business in exchange for money coming back through consultants and others, some of the underlying investigations to that prosecution have seen convictions on theories of depriving the citizens of Illinois of the honest services of an official because the person who conspired with the official knew the official would be rendering a decision based not on the merits within the confines of his office, but on some personal predilection to award business to friends. Now, in Illinois, I can tell you, there's a high degree of tolerance for that kind of thing, and defense lawyers like to try their cases on those issues to Chicago juries because there's a certain feeling here that the way Illinoisans govern themselves, some of that is okay. And I think that speaks to John Baker's point about whether the federal government really has the authority to second-guess that decision among people of Illinois who vote on their own statutes and who elect their own legislators to pass statutes to enforce what they deem is important and not what they deem isn't.
Self-government includes the right to have, elect, and tolerate bad government. The federal government is there to prevent bad government in one state from infecting people in other states. And to the extent that you follow federalism, there is a legitimate federal role in quarantining a state. And the classic for this was the beginning of the Lottery Act, and it was aimed at Louisiana, although that doesn't show up in the case. And the Lottery Act, in the Lottery Act, Congress came along and didn't declare gambling in Louisiana illegal. What it prohibited was the movement of lottery tickets over state lines, because that would undermine the prohibitions against lotteries in other states. So the Congress was protecting other states from, quote, a rogue state. That is what the founders designed. It's laid out in Federalist 10. And however well-meaning the Justice Department is, the reality is it's undermining self-government.
This is John Klein. If I can just jump in for a second. Following up on Jim's point, I think it's one thing to say that there ought to be a federal avenue to prosecute a Blagojevich, where there is, as Jim says, clear allegations of bribery. It's quite another thing to say that the federal government ought to be able to prosecute a Robert Sorich, where there's no allegation of bribery. There's nothing remotely resembling the kind of impropriety alleged in the Blagojevich case. That, in my view, ought to be a matter for the states and the local entities of the city of Chicago to regulate for themselves. I'd say the same thing about Wyrock. As I understand the facts of that case, contrary to Bill's view, it's not a bribery case. There's no quid pro quo. It's a non-disclosure case. The question is whether Wyrock should have disclosed his negotiations with this company while he was deciding whether to vote a particular way on this bill. And that, too, ought to be a matter for the states to decide, the degree of disclosure that their legislators ought to make. In fact, Alaska did decide it, and they decided that Wyrock didn't have to disclose this sort of thing. And a federal prosecutor came in and decided that his unelected view of what ought to be disclosed was superior in some way to those of the views of the people of Alaska. I think that's just it's wrong. It's contrary to the way criminal law has been administered and ought to be administered. And it's certainly in tension with the federalist the federalism system that we have.
This is Bill Otis. Let me respond to a couple of the points that have been made. As to Wyrock, the point has been made that what was really going on was an undisclosed conflict of interest. Well, the thing that was undisclosed was that he was being offered a well-paying job at the same time that he was writing a provision of the law that was currently being considered, that at that time was being considered by the Alaska legislature, that would have considerably benefited his future employer. I think, again, an ordinary understanding of that is it is a quid pro quo. It is not merely an undisclosed conflict of interest, although it is that as well. In response to the earlier point that in Chicago or in Illinois, this sort of corruption is just how it's done. It's business as usual. For many years while I was a federal prosecutor, I saw the, quote, business as usual defense many times in these white-collar cases. The problem is that we're businesses. Look, there are segments of the community in which dealing crack cocaine is business as usual. That's just too bad. Federal law prohibits it, and we are going to continue, or the Department of Justice, no longer we, the Department of Justice, I hope, is going to continue to enforce it. The example that I brought up earlier about rampant dishonesty, destroying the trust upon which legal, civic, and commercial life depends, was shown in bold relief in this banking crisis. What lay at the root of the banking crisis wasn't bribery, it wasn't kickbacks. It was people, you know, thousands if not millions of people, lying on mortgage applications about their income, their assets, and their pre-existing debt. And then when these fraudulently obtained and unsustainable mortgages for people who could not afford what they claimed to be able to afford, were bundled up by equally dishonest bankers and sold on the secondary securities market. The problem spread. When the bubble burst, the mortgage applicants could not pay the mortgages they had dishonestly obtained, and there was a tremendous amount of damage to millions of innocent people who lost their life savings, who lost their retirement, who had to go to work flipping burgers at McDonald's while they were in their 70s because of other people's dishonesty.
John Klein or John Baker, any final thoughts?
This is John Klein. I continue to believe that the federal criminal power is not a all-encompassing weapon against dishonesty. I think it's a blunt tool that ought to be used only in the most egregious cases. And I think that Skilling, to some extent, recognizes that. It has paired the honest services statute back to what ought to be the most egregious cases, bribery and kickbacks. I think that's less good than declaring the statute unconstitutional, as Justice Scalia would have done. But I think it's a good step, and properly enforced by the lower courts, I think it'll channel the statute in an appropriate direction.
With that, I'd like to thank our participants, Bill Otis, John Klein, and John Baker, and thank our listeners for listening. We hope you enjoyed this this Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. That concludes our podcast today.